This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me Alain Pape, professor of history at the University of Exeter in England. Alain Pape was born in Israel, but is highly critical of the Israeli occupation. His works include A History of Modern Palestine, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, and with Noam Chomsky, Gaza in Crisis. His most recent work is The Forgotten Palestinians, A History of the Palestinians in Israel. Alain Pape, welcome to Progressive Radio.
It's a pleasure to be on your program, Max.
Well, it's a real pleasure to meet you. I've been reading your work for years and years now, and it's nice to get to sit down and talk to you. Tell me a little bit, if you would, about your background.
Right. As you mentioned, I was born in Israel in the early 1950s and had a kind of conventional, I would say, Israeli-Jewish background until after my military service, which, I, as you know, is compulsory in Israel. And I participated in the 1973 war. And I think from there on, I started a trajectory, a journey that had different stations, but none of them had a return ticket, so to speak.
What sparked the journey?
My guess is that although I think the war of 73, as being a young soldier there, was an eye-opener, I did not digest what I saw until I left the country to do my PhD studies in Oxford in England, which happened or coincided with the first Israeli assault on Lebanon in 1982, which for us as Israeli Jews was the first war that had no clear justification. I mean, later on I understood that also the others were quite questionable. But the 1982 war seemed like a choice war.
And it was a war that killed almost 20,000 people.
Exactly. And it was very clear that it was instigated by Israel. Even if you were not a sophisticated observer, it was clear. And being outside of Israel, meeting for the first time Palestinian colleagues, I lived in a very segregated community in Israel before I came to England, and having an Arab supervisor, among others, and a Marxist supervisor at a dream team, also helped to open up. And there, the road was quite short. When I came back to Israel, I joined the Communist Party in 1989, 1990, not so much as being a communist, although I was, I still am, an ardent socialist, but because this was the only venue for someone who, as a Jew, began to develop anti-Zionist ideas. Mm. And from there on, the sort of fusion of my research with the development of my political ideas created, I think, the person I am.
And the Labour Party was inhospitable to you?
Yeah, it was. It was. Although I, you know, in my student days, I did a BA in Israel. I was still close to the Labour Party, and in the mid 1980s, I still had some connection, especially later on with the team that did the Oslo Accord, as well. I think they were more hospitable to me than I was towards them. I mean, I don't exactly know, and nobody can tell you. People like me can never tell you when exactly was the moment you really leave the camp. You hover on the boundaries of the tribal camp, if you want. And then one day you cross the boundary and you're outside the tribe and there's no way back.
Hmm. I'm speaking with Alain Pape. He's professor of history at the University of Exeter. He's written some incredibly path-breaking books, including History of Modern Palestine, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, and his latest, The Forgotten Palestinians, A History of the Palestinians in Israel. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at The Progressive Magazine. So you left the tribe, and you say there's no return ticket. In your work, you write that you've been ostracized by your tribe, that you're a pariah in your own community. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
Yes, and when I said I'm a pariah in my own community, I meant mainly the academic milieu, because the society at large is always a much more open and fluid concept, and people who know you intimately can differentiate between views and personality and so on. The academic world is not open up to such ideas. What you think is who you are. And roughly the beginning of the 21st century, after the second uprising, second intifada, I began to be ostracized by my own community of peers, of my own academic community. And it had to do with the fact that, unlike so many other anti-Zionist academics, I was teaching the topics of Zionism as a professional historian. You see, if you take someone like Israel Shachak before me, he taught chemistry and had anti-Zionist views. But I taught about Zionism. I mean, the state paid me in a way to teach about Zionism, and I did it in a way that was too much for them. And it just got worse by the day. And it started also to affect my postgraduate students and so on, my choice of courses, my activity as a whole. So, yeah, it was quite unpleasant, you know.
So you were pushed out, essentially, from the academy, unless you wanted just to do the courses that they left you as scraps?
Oh, yes. No, the university authorities in Haifa made it very clear that I should leave. They were the typical Israeli way of telling you that you are unwanted. It's not a very subtle society.
No, you call yourself an anti-Zionist. Why?
Because I came to the conclusion that both the concept of Zionism as it developed historically in Palestine in the beginning of the 20th century and what Zionism stands for today are two ideological takes of reality which I find very repugnant, to put it bluntly, and which one I cannot side with. The historical Zionist concept I studied shows that Zionism was just another case study of settler colonialism, which I know its historical circumstances, but I definitely don't want to be someone who is part of it. Zionism today is even worse, I think. It's an ideology of exclusion. It defines who has the right and who hasn't the right to live normal life within any space that Israel controls. And I find that objecting this ideology, for me, is the right moral and ethical thing to do.
Ilan Pappé, the early Zionism, some aspects of or strands of early Zionism was more accommodating to Palestinians than the current kind of crude Zionism that we're seeing in Israel today.
Absolutely, and I can sympathize with the people like Martin Buber or the Zionist communist, if you want, in a way, who were looking for a binational existence or a more universal kind of a partnership. But I think in the end of the day, and that's maybe my argument with the liberal Zionists, when someone puts a boot on your face, the fact that the guy who puts the boot on your face holds the Bible or Marx is not very relevant to the person whose face it is, if you know what I mean.
Speaking with Ilan Pappé, you still identify as a Jew, as an anti-Zionist Jew?
Yeah, I have no problem with my... I feel very strong to my Jewish origins and heritage. I think it's a much more universal heritage than it is nowadays presented by Zionists and so on. I'm not a religious person. I'm an atheist. So it doesn't mean much for me from a religious point of view. But I definitely see it as a heritage and a culture and civilization I'm very proud to be part of. However, I always tell my students, I think, that nobody should question a person's wish to be identified as something. The question is, what does it mean, this identification? And I cannot accept an identification which allows you to oppress, to colonize, to occupy, to dispossess, and so on. So I had to navigate between my own personal understanding of this identity and the way this identity is manipulated and employed for the kind of unjust policies that are being carried out on the ground as we speak.
In a sense, that's the tragedy of Israel for many Jews who are critical of the policies of the state of Israel, because for, 5,000 years, Jews have stood for justice and for liberation, and then in the last 60 years, they've been doing the reverse.
Yes, I always say that People say, do you have a problem with Israel being a Jewish state? I said, I wish it were a Jewish state. It's not a Jewish state, because if it had were a Jewish state, it would have been loyal to the way I understand Judaism, and it would have behaved in a very different way. So yes, I totally agree. I think divorcing Judaism from Zionism would be such a healthy development for everyone concerned.
Mm. Healthy because?
It would be healthy because, A, Jews around the world would be released, liberated from the need to identify with something which is now quite obvious, a policy of oppression, occupation and colonization. And the ethnic group that developed in Israel, which is also Jewish, but is also part of the Palestinian and Palestine background, may feel more naked in a way, and would be more forced to find an accommodating solution with the indigenous people they colonized. And I think it's healthy. It's very healthy for the people who are now sort of belong to the 7 million people who define themselves as Jews in Israel to realize from a different, a new departure point where they live. This is Palestine. This is the Arab world. If you want to be part of Europe, for good reasons or bad reasons, go back to Europe. But if you want to be part of the Middle East, which I think is an exciting place nowadays, so remember who you are and who are the people who live here and try to be part of it, not be an alien element in it.
But that recognition seems distant right now because it seems to me anyway that a couple generations now of Israelis have grown up with this supremacist attitude.
You know, one can be very negative about it or positive or pessimist or optimist about it. I would say that in yours and mine, my height, we have the chance of seeing both the empty and the full side of the cup. You're right, in one sense. The racist discourse in Israel has reached new altitudes. The unashamed way by which Israeli politicians and journalists use this racist discourse is undeniable. On the other hand, I noticed in Israel quite a few parents who think that their children should study Arabic or learn Arabic. And I ask them why. And they say, because in the end of the day, however we're going to tweak it, we'll have to live with the Arabs in one place. So I think if one could coach it in the right way and be involved deeply, as I would like to when I finish my academic career, hopefully not in the near future, I would like to be involved in actually in this kind of educational effort. I haven't lost faith in the ability to counter the hegemonic forces when it comes to education and understanding of the reality of Israelis and Palestinians in that piece of land.
So, Alain Pape, you see yourself going back and working on this issue there?
Oh, yes. Yes, I definitely would like to go back, never to the Israeli academia, which I think is a lost case, but I would like to go back and deal a lot with what I would call adult education. I think there's a lot to be done there. One has to say, by the way, that it's a very long-term project. Therefore, your analysis is right. And in the meantime, there's a lot of other things we should do, like pressuring Israel with sanctions and boycott and divestment. I mean, the two are not mutually exclusive. I think long-term education and short-term political pressure complement each other.
Talk a little bit more about the boycott, divestment, sanction movement.
Yeah, I came to that conclusion after a very painful internal discussion with myself, because I think it's a very drastic move. It's a very drastic move to call on the world to boycott your own society or sanction it or divest. It doesn't matter. It comes from the same family. But I really think it comes from two conclusions. One conclusion is that the chance of transforming Israel from within in the near future is very slim, and that the so-called peace process is leading nowhere. And you have this successful example of the past of South Africa, and I think that the moment the Palestinian civil society actually opted for the BDS instead of an armed struggle in many ways, is very important moment in history. And it really gives a lot of moral and ethical validity to this strategy. And it's not surprising that a lot of progressive Jews are leading in many ways the BDS campaign elsewhere in the world, and here in this country as well, because it makes moral, ethical, and political chance. And although my friend Noam Chomsky did not agree with me, that's why we decided to write a book together on this, I think even he would, he was not worried about the ethical side. He was worried about the efficiency, the effectiveness. And he has a good, as always, he makes some very good and convincing points. But I think its effectiveness is not the issue right now. And it will be, it's already proven to be quite effective, contrary to the worries that people had about it.
And the ethical side is its commitment to nonviolence.
Exactly. It's committed to nonviolence. The oppressed people themselves ask you to do this. It's an engagement. It's a conversation. I mean, we can call it boycott, divestment, and sanction. But this is not just, it's not a punitive action. It's a kind of a dialogue that you say to people in Israel, you know, morally what you do is unacceptable to the degree that we think that you should not be part of the civilized nations when you continue to do this. What is your response? We already have seen a response. I mean, for the first time, the heads of Israeli universities showed some concern about the situation of academic freedom inside the occupied territories. Without the BDS, this would have never happened. So they are involved, whether they like it or not, in the conversation, of course, in conditions that they're not used to. They used to occupy and to be in charge. They're not in charge of this conversation. They are indicted. They are accused of something, and they have to answer back. They don't like this situation. I know it's not a comfortable. All my life I've been in that situation, so I know it's not comfortable. But it's a very healthy educational trip for them.
I'm speaking with Alain Pape. He's the professor of history at the University of Exeter, who's written some incredible books on Israel and Palestine, including A History of Modern Palestine and The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. He mentioned Noam Chomsky. A second ago, they worked together on a book called Gaza in Crisis. Pape's most recent work is The Forgotten Palestinians, A History of the Palestinians in Israel. I wanted to talk to you about that because we hear a lot, especially American Jews hear a lot, but also everyone in the United States, I think, hears a lot. Israel's the only democracy in the Middle East, and Palestinian Arabs in Israel have full citizenship rights. They're equal. Your book rebuts that. Tell me about that.
Yes, I think you're right. I think the ultimate test for checking and examining the notion that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East is its treatment of its own Arab citizens. And I think the end result of such an examination shows that this is a fable, that this is another fabrication. They really test the Israelis in the most sensitive way, the Palestinian community in Israel. The whole idea of Israel is that it can remain a democracy if it retains a demographic majority. Now, with the years, turned out that it doesn't only need to be a demographic majority, it has to be a decisive demographic majority. Namely, if the Palestinians in Israel cross the threshold of 30% or 35%, even liberal Zionists would say that one should doubt whether Israel should continue to be a democracy, and maybe for the sake of survival, you should give up on certain democratic characteristics in order to make sure that the state remains Jewish. So I think they really confront the Israelis on a daily basis with the worst kind of fabrication that Zionism stood for, that you can be democratic even if you are a bit racist in your idea of how this democracy should work. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work. Now, because of that, the Palestinians in Israel were first put under military rule so as to exclude them from the common Republican good, if you want. And then when the military regime was transferred to the new kind of Palestinians that Israel occupied in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, a very complex matrix of power is in place to make sure that you are a citizen, but you're not really a citizen. So you are a citizen as long as you are not disrupting the demographic balance. This is a weird occupation, if you think about it, preoccupation, which I think distinguishes me and my other friends who are dissidents from the rest of the Israeli public. We really think that this is sickening, this whole demographic preoccupation. It's even worse if you think about the Nazis in this respect, and I don't want to expand on this, but I think this is really terrible. It's a kind of a racist preoccupation and discourse.
Even the common phrase demographic bomb is hideous.
Exactly. I remember teachers in my own university in Haifa sitting in front of mixed classes and talking about the Palestinian birth rate as a demographic bomb. And I used to ask them, the students, there were human beings sitting in your class, and you told them that if they're going to have another brother or sister, they're going to be a bomb, a demographic threat. And most of the most liberal Israelis don't see any problem with this. And I think once you have the same guts reaction as I do to that kind of a discourse, this kind of conversation, you are out of the camp, in a good way, I think. And once you don't have a problem with this, but you try to say, you know, I would settle for a smaller part of Palestine. I'd be racist. This is like the liberal left Zionist parties. I'd be racist, but in a smaller part of Palestine. And I say, whether you are racist in a small part or a large part, doesn't matter. The fact that you are racist matters. And you cannot solve this problem unless you accept that people should be equal. And the only solution is a state for all its citizens. The moment you partition, the moment you segregate and say, okay, I'll be racist in 20% of Palestine, 60% of Palestine. Anyway, the left Zionists want to be racist in 80% of Palestine. So it's not just a big concession, if you think about it. But this is where the core of the issue is, and this is the kind of debate you are not allowed to have in Israel. And I think it's one of the main reasons that you need to coerce Israel to have this debate.
And this collision between a democratic Israel and a Israel that's just a Jewish state and very undemocratic, that collision has led you, or your observation of that collision has led you to a one-state solution as opposed to a two-state solution. And why don't you explain why that is?
Yes. I must say, over the years, I made a distinction between the political outfit, whether it's a one state, a federated state, a binational state, and the observation that the state should be a vehicle. Otherwise, it's a fascist notion. If the state is an objective by itself, it's a fascist notion. It has to be a vehicle, it has to be a tool. And whatever the outfit is, to begin with, it is an outfit that should safeguard equal human and civil rights to everyone concerned. In this particular case study is also the right of people who were expelled to return. Now, logically, to my mind, the two-state solution, however you're going to engineer it, cannot provide this a kind of basis for equality. And the more unitary the political outfit is, the better or the easier it is to safeguard these equal rights. And I think that it's really a normal human wish to live more or less how people live in this place, where your religious identity, your ethnic identity, your national identity does not determine your status of citizenship. I'm not sure you can ensure it in two-state solution.
That's the problem of living in any kind of theological state.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
We've got about 5 minutes left at Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive. My guest is Ilan Pappe, professor of history at the University of Exeter, author most recently of The Forgotten Palestinians, A History of the Palestinians in Israel. He also recently wrote a book with Noam Chomsky called Gaza in Crisis. And I think it was in that book where you talked about what it might take for the U.S. government to withdraw its unconditional support for Israel. And you gave an interesting answer given the developments of the last year. You said, externally, a collapse of the U.S. Middle Eastern policy, mainly through the downfall of one of its allies, might bring about that change in U.S. policy. We've had the downfall of Mubarak.
That's right.
U.S. policy remains pretty stagnant, though.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that if that's proven true, and whether what more needs to be done, and also, of course, what effect has these dramatic changes in the Middle East had as far as U.S. policy or Israel for that matter.
Yeah, I still think, of course, one can always change one's predictions, but I still stand behind that one. I don't think that Egypt has completed the transformation, and therefore, examining my hypothesis is a bit too early. The military is still in control. The military is still an ally of the Americans. A genuine democracy in Egypt would transform dramatically the relationship between Egypt and Israel. And the whole setup in the region would change. For the first time, I think the more democratic these regimes would, these countries would become, the more they would abide by the wishes of the society to take a far more firm position on Israel and Palestine. And the American squaring of circle, which you could do with its former allies, you could sort of be pro-Israeli and have allies in the Middle East who didn't care much about Palestine. This will disappear. So I think an American administration that would have to ask itself and would say to itself, I have to make a decision. I have to make a decision. Do I support the Arab world as a whole, which means I also support the Palestinian cause, or do I support Israel and antagonize the rest of the Arab world? This is what I meant. And I think this moment of truth is there, almost there, around the corner.
No, Obama tried to have it both ways with his speech at Cairo, which is a very forward-looking speech, but his policy toward Israel, I mean, it seems like Netanyahu just thumbs his nose at Obama, and no matter what Obama's trying to do, Netanyahu trumps him because Netanyahu knows he's got tremendous support in Congress.
It's true, but I think also Congress knows that whatever Netanyahu does so far doesn't undermine the American relationship with Saudi Arabia, with the Gulf states, even with Egypt. And Syria is also not going in a way that undermines so far American supremacy in the region. However, this can change. It's and I think it's about to change. And it would be very interesting. I mean, you could either have a kind of a neocon Capitol Hill, which says, okay, so in this case, we are more isolated than we thought, and we'll forget about the Middle East, which they can't easily do because of oil and corporation interests and so on. Or, as I said, they will have to make for the first time a decision that they didn't make in the 60 years of Israel's existence. If you have an American national interest, is the rest of the Arab world less important than one kind of a state like Israel? With all the problems that it brings. So I really think that there will be a clarity of choice, which doesn't mean that I know exactly how American presidents will think about it, but I think they had an easy way out of it, which the new Arab Spring has a potential to change.
It may not be so easy in the years ahead. Ilan Pappé, unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you for being my guest on Progressive Radio.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.